Welcome to the Religious Feminism Podcast. I'm your host, April Young Bennett, and today we're going to be talking about Hindu feminism, and I'll let my guest introduce herself.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. My name is Soumya Arya Haz. I'm a Hindu priestess. I am an American Hindu, so what I'll be talking about today is the situation in feminism and for Hindus in the United States. I might touch on issues in India because they are related, but I really am an American much more than I am an Indian.
All right, let's talk about some of the positive things that you value about your Hindu faith and your Hindu community.
Well, I would say the first thing is just the vast diversity of beliefs and attitudes and life experiences. Especially being in the United States, I've been able to meet Hindus not only from India, but from all around the world. There are many Americans who have never been to India, many Americans who are not of Hindu or not of Indian heritage, who have adopted Hinduism as their chosen faith. This leads in really well for my life experience. My father was from India, and after various perambulations around the globe, ended up in Minnesota in the U.S. But my mother's family is Caribbean. She was brought up in South America in Guyana, but her family was from all over the Caribbean and way back when, due to British colonialism, had been relocated to the Caribbean. So her experience of Hinduism and her traditions were different than my dad's. So from a young age, I was aware of the diversity. And then as I grew older and started meeting other Hindus in the U.S., working with Hindu organizations, I really got to see that diversity just exponentially increase. So I think it's important, first of all, whenever we're talking about Hinduism, and especially as you're listening to this interview, I can only talk about my own experience. There are roughly a billion Hindus in the world, and I can't represent all of them.
Absolutely. I know that often we are asked to tell someone all about our religion, and it's like, well, my own brother or sister will have different opinions than I will.
Yes,
so of course,
absolutely.
We can only talk about our own experience.
Absolutely. When you get a bunch of Hindus, a bunch of Christians, a bunch of atheists, anybody together in the same room, there are always points of intersection, points of difference.
Can you tell us a little bit about your feminist community?
Well, I think that there is a very strong current of feminism, you know, in Hinduism traditionally, although, you know, much of that has been reconstructed by looking back at works that were neglected, finding threads and stories. And in modern Hinduism in the U.S., there's a very, very strong feminist dialogue. And, you know, that dialogue is intersectional. One of the things that I really appreciate, first of all, I'm in my 40s, and I love to hear what the younger generation, I have two adult nieces, and, you know, talking to them or talking to their peers or to younger folks that I've met, you know, at conferences and so on, or people that I'm giving spiritual counsel to, is, you know, seeing it's very different for the younger generation. And I, you know, I try to learn from them. And, you know, the word intersectional is a newer word, but I think that a lot of feminists are really being thoughtful about what that word means to us. And so for me, for example, a lot of listening that I have to do is, first of all, from the younger generation, you know, understanding where our generation's feminism might not be their feminism. And listening to opinions and life experiences that are vastly different from my own, especially in terms of privilege. My dad was a very prominent Hindu figure in India, and my family is Brahmin. So we are, you know, what's called a high caste, meaning we have caste privilege. And, you know, Hinduism for people who are encountering it without that caste privilege, or daily life in the Indian community for people without caste privileges, is really thorny and difficult. And listening to other feminists talk about that particular issue in the beginning was very difficult for me. The best analogy I can make is having caste privilege is like having white privilege in the United States. And that when we're confronted by the system, it can be a little bit of a shock. And then when we're confronted by our own actions and our own embedded attitudes, it can be very painful to kind of pull that apart and understand we inadvertently or deliberately have been part of a system of oppression. So the same goes for LGBTQ folks in Hinduism, I mean, in any society, but, you know, the Hindu community especially is my concern, is, you know, understanding that as someone who passes for straight, that I have to really be careful and conscious and try to use my privilege to leverage an opening for other people. So I would say a lot of what's happening in feminism right now in the Hindu American community is starting to examine some of these places where kind of our classic older generation feminism has sort of failed because we didn't see these people. So there are similar issues going on in India, but again, you know, that's a little bit out of my lane. So I would say that, you know, right now feminism and Hinduism is thankfully being driven a lot by younger folks, and they're bringing to our attention issues that we might not have been very thoughtful of.
So tell me a little bit about the status of women in your faith. It sounds like it varies by caste. Are there any other ways that the status of women vary from men?
Well, you know, I think that the status for women is really in some ways, you know, very fortunate, in other ways very unfortunate. And, you know, doing work with Hindu organizations in the U.S., the majority of these organizations have a very strong female leadership. So that is very heartening, is that a lot of the dialogue, a lot, if you do a Google search for American Hindus and, you know, you find articles or you find descriptions of conferences, there's a strong presence of women, but that can be a little bit misleading. And it's really tough. It's difficult being a minority in the United States dealing with issues in your own community, because we're constantly striving against a stereotype. And the stereotype, when I introduce myself to people and, you know, they see that I'm brown skinned and, you know, if religion comes up, they hear I'm Hindu or I'm of Indian heritage, often their very first reaction is sympathy, kind of implied, oh, that must be a difficult thing to be. Now that gets tiring because as a minority, you know, we want to represent ourselves. But at the same time, they're right. Being a Hindu woman, for me anyway, is a difficult thing to be. I cannot write an article, give an interview, or really express any opinion without getting kind of a slew of emails, 95% from men telling me I'm doing it wrong. Or as a woman, you know, telling me I'm being oppressed wrong. Or that I don't get it, or that this is harmful to our community to talk about these issues. So it's very difficult. I don't think that the Hindu American community is particularly egalitarian in terms of gender identity. So there's really, you know, but again, it's really difficult. And often the impact that we can make is the hardest, you know, the hardest impact, which is to confront the people we're closest to confront, you know, our fathers, our brothers, our husbands, uncles, whoever, or women, because women are just as much part of upholding patriarchy as men are. So that's the really hard work. It's much easier for me to write an article kind of addressing Americans or addressing the Hindu American community. But it can be a lot harder to look at someone who I care about and have a relationship with face to face and say, hey, that attitude is really a problem for me and this is why. So in that way, I don't think the struggle is any different than the struggle for women in any community.
I do see that everywhere. And I love how you mentioned that women are involved in upholding patriarchy, because I found that to be true as well. Sometimes people think it's a women versus men thing, but not really.
Right, not really. And I think in most communities, you find that a lot of what is now called social justice work, my family called it community service, Yes, of course, there are many men who are doing that service, but, you know, it's often usually women who are in the kitchen cooking, who are distributing meals, you know, who are maneuvering kind of the ins and outs of really embedded community. And it's especially challenging for, I think, for Hindus in America. And here I'm speaking mostly people of Indian subcontinent heritage, because we don't want our traditions to go away, obviously. I don't see any kind of conflict between being Hindu and being American. I see that as one of the enriching parts of my culture. But what can be very difficult to face is this idea of tradition, which is, you know, which again, you know, really varies, because tradition can be kind of called up and used as a cudgel against people. And when you do something that is perceived as new, whether it's new or not, often you can be told, well, you know, you're destroying this tradition. I have many Hindus tell me, well, you're not really Hindu, because Hindus don't believe what you believe, and Hindu women don't behave as you behave. This used to really bother me, and I used to push back and say, well, I am a Hindu, and, you know, kind of cite my lineage or whatever. And then I realized, you know what? No, you don't want to accept me as Hindu. That's your problem. That's not my problem. And I also saw that the thing I used to lean on, which was my lineage, was kind of problematic, because by saying, oh, well, my family have been priests back into whatever the Dark Ages, using that as a way to prove my sort of authenticity is inadvertently kind of demeaning the people who don't have that lineage. So my reaction at this point, especially, you know, to men, is to kind of shrug and say, fine, you know, don't consider me Hindu, that's all right.
It's up to them how they think, but it doesn't change you, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, you know, as being part of a community, like, this is, it's difficult. You know, it's difficult because we have the community we're born into, and then we have the community that we make for ourselves. And I've kind of come to the conclusion, not only as a Hindu, but just as a person, that I'm responsible for creating the community I want to be a part of. You know, I'm responsible for forming a group of people who are able to disagree without dehumanizing each other and, you know, being being told, oh, you're not this, you're not that. So I think, I mean, as a Hindu priestess, for example, and here after saying I don't like talking about it, I, you know, open by talking about my parents. My mother's family, you know, again, had a very different experience of Hinduism in the Caribbean, and there were a good number of women who functioned publicly as priestesses. So I, in India at the time, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but it was pretty rare for a woman to identify as a priestess in what that word implicated, that you were kind of doing this in a public way, not just in your home. And I have had other Hindus tell me straight out, there's no such thing as a Hindu priestess. Now, that used to be really offensive to me. Now I laugh. I'm like, well, here I am standing before you. What are you, how are you going to reconcile that? And, you know, accepting that that's theirs to reconcile, not mine.
So what are the goals of some of the feminists within the Hindu community?
I would say it's the role of a feminist in any community, again, with that little wrinkle of, you know, being members of a minority, either religiously or racially. And that's to let our voices be heard and to let, you know, to want people to listen thoughtfully, to consider. And we want things to change. We want women to be able to, first of all, express themselves verbally, and secondly, to express themselves in terms of how they're living their lives. That we would like to be considered fully formed humans, fully formed people, and that the way we choose to live be respected. It's tiring, you know, it's tiring doing this work, and it can be especially disheartening when you have surrounded yourself with a close community of supportive people, and you feel very much that, yes, I am allowed, I'm encouraged to voice opinions, to voice dissent, and then you start running up into walls when you kind of get outside of that community, whether it's at work, whether it's in your home life, or just in the community in general, is, I think, you know, as feminists, as women, we would simply like to live our lives without having to justify our choices to everyone.
Absolutely. So what do you think are some of the barriers that prevent us from doing that, or rather prevent, well, I guess all women, particularly Hindu women?
I think this sort of bludgeon of tradition, which, you know, isn't always posited that way, but sort of this idea that there was a time where women happily worked in the home and had children and supported their husband's life outside of the home. And this weird idea that, well, women were very happy and fulfilled in this. Now, of course, some women were and some women still are with that role, but many of us are not. And then even if you are fulfilled in that role, struggling to be respected, to have, you know, what used to be called women's work, the work of child rearing, the work of keeping house, the work of raising children, to have that be as respected as the work that men are doing outside the home, so that women can kind of have that choice. And, you know, also when that work is denigrated, it creates barriers to men doing that work. I know a number of Hindu men who have been stay-at-home dads, and I think they encounter the same kind of difficulty that stay-at-home dads have in our larger American culture. Well, people kind of look at them like, well, that's weird. Well, why is that weird? Or men who are congratulated for babysitting their children, that particularly enrages me. I don't have children myself, but it's like, wait, wait, what?
I have children, and yes, in my community, yes, they say that too, and it's ridiculous.
And I mean, it's great that men are praised and encouraged to do this, but I'd like to see women praised and encouraged for doing it. And, you know, I'd like to hear men being asked the question, you know, men who are successful in their careers. It's rare. I don't know if I've ever heard an interview where a man is asked, how do you balance your home life and your career? And women are asked that all the time. Now, it is a pertinent question, because I think for women, it can be more of a struggle to balance their home and career, because their career is seen as taking away from something else. Whereas with men, it's seen as adding to the home life while men are supporting us, blah, blah, blah. And especially now, like, it's, you know, stay-at-home moms are a little bit unusual, because we're living in a time where our economy doesn't really allow for single-income households very much. So I would say that, you know, that's kind of a difficulty, or the idea that, God, like, you know, that getting married is the be-all end-all, which kind of plays back to that old song of women are fulfilled by staying at home and having children in wedlock. So that kind of implies you need a husband to get you started. And so a lot of things I heard as a girl were, because I was, you know, very athletic, I rode horses, I was very outspoken. And the thing I heard the most is, well, you're never going to get a husband. So that was what girls were essentialized to, is you need to be the kind of girl that will get a husband. That's really difficult to carry as a young person. And, you know, to have that message told to you the whole time you're growing up, you know, and then one thing that's, you know, nice, something that I think is valuable for many people in the Hindu American community is, you know, we value education. So women go to college, and I don't think going to college is as much of a barrier as it can be for other communities, that people are encouraged to get an education. But then there you are, sometimes with a graduate degree and a successful career, and still kind of being told, well, where's your husband? Or how are you balancing your responsibilities to your family and to your career? So that can be very frustrating. And I think that, you know, the other issue that's difficult that I touched on a little bit is we are, you know, embedded in a community that the wider world sees in a particular way. And one of the things that you hear about all the time, you know, with Hindus, no matter where we are in the world or what our backgrounds are, is that women are oppressed. And so at the same time, I want to push back against that in the sort of wider life of being American and having a voice in the United States is to say, well, women are oppressed everywhere. And yes, women are oppressed, but, you know, could we talk about something else? And then you get a lot of pushback in your community where people are like, look, we're trying to do all this work to change people's perspectives, to represent ourselves as we are, which is complicated. We are all complicated people, and our communities are complicated. And look, now you're running around talking about problems for women and problems for caste. Aren't you undoing all of this work? And, you know, again, it's difficult because we can't, I, as a Hindu, can't talk about my experience without talking about the difficulties of being a woman, the difficulties of caste, and the difficulties of class and colorism and all of those things as well.
So have you seen any progress towards gender equity in your community?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that there's still a great deal of work to be done. I think that there's still a tendency as in any community or any family to keep problems quiet, to not sort of bring shame on the family by talking about problems, by, you know, talking about abuse or mental illness or other kinds of struggles that people have. And I think that that is broadening. I think that there are more women talking about abuse. I think that there are more women, you know, talking about mental health issues, talking about casteism. And I think that we're also able, you know, because of the internet, to encounter views that we might not be hearing in an insular community, that I am able to read the perspectives and hear about perspectives of similar struggles, not only from Hindu women around the world, but from other women, in, you know, all over the world. And I think that that's been a very broadening and eye-opening experience for many people. And, you know, the sort of second wave feminism statement of the personal is political, I think that it took me a really long time. That phrase comes back to me a lot. And I think one of the most powerful moments in my life is when I was at community college in Minnesota in the mid-90s, realizing, really, really seeing for the first time that the struggles I had as a woman were struggles I was having because I was a woman, not because I was me. And realizing that women all over the world who were very different from me, had those same struggles. So I think for the Hindu community, that's really important, is that in speaking out more, in, you know, in talking about our struggles and our challenges openly, we realize that we're not alone in these things. And that, you know, if you're, say, in a family where you're kind of told, oh, you know, suck it up, this is how it is, you're too aggressive, you know, you're too this, you're too that, you're not appreciative enough. You know, then you kind of go online and you read something from a woman halfway around the world, and she's saying the same things, and she's having the same struggles. So I think within our community, being able to simply say these are problems, and yes, there are problems, and these problems affect the majority of Hindu women, I think that that is the first step. I mean, admitting it is half the battle, it's only half the battle. But realizing that there is a battle to be fought is also very powerful. And having, you know, being both enraged and inspired by stories from other people in our community It strengthens us because we know we're not alone. And it motivates us because it's not just our lives that are at stake. It's every woman's life that's at stake. So I would say that a lot of progress has been made in terms of being more open. And I think once we start being open about problems, we can start solving them. Well, you can't really solve a hidden problem as a community. It has to be dragged out into the open. And that's very painful, but it's very necessary. So that's something that I think I've seen change a lot, especially in my community in the United States, but also in India. It's very disheartening because when we start opening up, it's like you look at the news or you talk to your girlfriend and there's horrible things happening. And that can be really horrifying and can kind of cause us to retreat because it's painful to keep encountering these stories. But what's important is that 30 years ago, these stories weren't being told at all. Women being abused or raped or exploited was something that was whispered about, not something that you would read in the newspaper. And as women all over the world, you know, have been finding more outlets, more places that will carry their words, more ways to reach an audience. You know, we're realizing this is endemic. This is everywhere. This is everyone. So it's difficult because the only way to solve the problem is to really face the problem. And, you know, that kind of reality, the reality of people's pain and suffering can be very overwhelming. And there are times that I certainly have just said, God, I need to not look at the news for a few days. And that's fine. Take a break. But we have to reengage. You know, we have to keep engaging. And we need to step away for our own mental balance. But we can't walk away from it. So, yes, I would say there's change, but, you know, change is always difficult and always hard won.
Right. And I love how you're explaining how awareness building works, because with an activist movement, one of the first steps we always need to do is to build awareness. And that can feel like you're moving backwards instead of forwards, because all these problems that used to be things that people didn't notice are coming to light and people are hearing about them. It can feel frustrating if the problems are increasing, but actually that's an important part of an activist movement, is that first people have to know the problem exists, they have to face it head on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's something I'm a religious studies scholar, and I've taken a lot of anthropology, and anthropology is a really interesting field to me. But one of the things that I like about kind of more contemporary anthropology that was, you know, not the case way back in the day, is that, you know, the idea that the first step to understanding is shutting up and listening. You know, I've done community service work, social justice work in India for many years because of my mom and dad's work. And it was always both bewildering, hilarious, and frustrating when people from outside India would show up with very good intentions and not a clue. Because they had already decided what the problems were, and they had already decided what the solutions were. And if you want to be an activist, you know, the first step is you have to listen and figure out what it is. I mean, most people know what they need. Most communities know what they need. And often what they just need is help realizing that. So, you know, for example, with my mom's activism in India, my family, mostly the women in my family, have been running an organization now for 30 years that provides basic needs and education. As people who did not need basic needs and education provided to us because we already had that because of our privilege, the first step to helping those communities was to going in and listening to what their problems were and then asking them, what can we do to help? So, as an activist, like, that's a really important step, especially if you're going out of your lane. If I want to help, you know, upper middle class Indian or Hindu women with caste privilege, like, I'm set. because that's me. But, you know, and there are certainly problems that you have, even if you have economic and caste and class privilege. But the people who really need help, I don't always understand what they need. And I need to be willing to listen and to hear things that might be difficult for me to hear, and simply to be a stepping stone for people's own journey, rather than having my helping them be a stepping stone to my journey, if that makes sense.
Yes, that does make sense. So do you have any other advice for people who are working towards gender equity in their own faith communities?
That's a difficult one. Again, I can only speak from my own experience, and some of what I have to say is a little disheartening. You know, don't give up. Step back when you need to, but don't step away. Build a community that will support you, even if it's online. You know, one of the things, I am pro-internet, and I understand the internet, especially right now, we're realizing has caused a lot of problems and complications, socially and politically. But I also think it's really powerful for people who are physically isolated. You know, as someone who lives with a disability and maybe did not always have people around me who also had a disability, I'm a traumatic brain injury survivor. When I had my accident, I didn't know anybody who had gone through what I had gone through. And it really helped to reach out on Facebook, on Twitter, you know, all over the place, and find other people that had my experience. I think if you're a young Hindu woman, you know, living in a small town somewhere in the middle of the United States, you would feel very isolated. You might be the only Indian family in your community. You might be the only girl in a larger community who is speaking up about things. So building, you know, reading articles, realizing you're not alone is really important, but it's also important to build and nurture a community that is a personal connection, whether it's in real life or whether it's online. You know, the other thing to acknowledge is that sometimes this work is unsafe. And the other advice I would give is really practical, which is protect yourself. Make sure your address is not easily available online. You know, if you want to be an activist and you feel, and often, I mean, I had been an activist for a very long time before I started receiving hate mail or death threats. And the first few times it happened, it was shocking. It was terrifying. I was like, oh my God, like, what have I done? And then, you know, are these people serious? And you can't know if those people are serious. So be practical. You know, be safe and be careful. And also acknowledge that for some people, doing this work is even more risky. You know, for if you are a woman in India, there are communities for which activism work is life-threatening. So don't sit back in your armchair and say, oh, well, you know, why aren't other people doing more? Well, often other people aren't doing more or aren't doing what you can see because it's very dangerous for them. And I don't want to scare people off, but this is frankly just the world we're living in. And, you know, the first credible death threats I got were credible because these people could find out where I lived. And that is something that can happen. It will happen very unexpectedly. And I certainly know activists who have gone their whole life without receiving a death threat. But as someone who has had to negotiate that, and I have had to sit down and decide, okay, is it worth it for me to take this personal risk and continue this work? The answer was absolutely. But I fully respect anyone who faces that, especially people who have kids. And say, yeah, I need to do this a different way. Like, I'm not safe. My family's not safe. So being a person who brings change is always going to be threatening. there are certainly portions of the Hindu community where I'm not really welcome anymore. And as I said, I've made my peace with that, but I'm able to make my peace with it because that's not my only community. If, again, I was living in a small community and really what I had for support around me, if that community didn't support me, it can be very isolating and very depressing. So I think it's important to build relationships, to have other perspectives, to have other women who are fighting similar, if not identical, values all over the place who can give us support. And it also kind of preemptively takes over the idea of being ostracized. Well, I don't care if certain communities ostracize me because I have other communities. So, again, that's maybe not very enthusiastic or inspiring advice, but it's something that I really tell people to be careful about now, is make sure your identity is protected. Both in terms of how we consider identity now with, you know, can people find your address online or so on and so forth. And, you know, make sure you're protecting your internal identity by having people around you who are nurturing. And don't give up. Don't give up. There's so many times that I've just thrown up my hands and said, this is pointless. Like, why am I exhausting myself? Why am I exposing myself to this kind of stuff, and, you know, nothing's making a difference. And it does make a difference, but it's not given to us to see the impact we're having. And honestly, I think that it can be easy to fall into a very understandable trap of doing activist work and doing social justice work that gives us immediate feedback. Because we need, you know, we all want to know that we're making a difference. We want to know that our work is valued. But it can be easy to fall into this pattern of only confronting things that you know will give you good feedback right away. Because otherwise you feel like you're shouting into the void. And we're not shouting into a void. Someone is there listening, and we don't know how many lives we might be changing. If we only change one other person's life, like, I'm okay with that. Sometimes I think if my life is the only one I change, I might have to be okay with that. And here's something where the internet can also be very difficult, is ages ago when I was first starting to write for Huffington Post, I wrote an article I was very excited about. I put a lot of work into it. It was kind of risky for me to write it, and I posted it, and I was like, okay, hooray, you know, now the thousands of likes will come, and they didn't. Nobody saw it. Nobody read it. Nobody cared. And that was one of the moments where I kind of threw up my hands as a writer. And I was like, well, why am I doing this? What's the point? I may as well just write in my diary. That article is the article that when I often ask people, how did you hear about me? That's the article that they mention. That article was written 6 or 7 years ago, which in the internet is like, you know, 1,000 years.
1,000, yeah.
Yes, you know, and every time it happens, I kind of laugh at myself, because I wanted that instant feedback. I wanted to feel heard right away. I wanted to know that someone was out there, that I wasn't shouting into the void. And now I look back at that despair that I felt. Like, nobody's listening. I'm never going to have an impact. Nobody cares about this. I was wrong. Lots of people cared. But, you know, people don't owe me a thank you. And that's also important to remember, is that this is thankless work, and that's not always a bad thing.